You are listening to the Already Gone podcast, sharing stories of the missing, the murdered, the mysterious, and the lost.
A friendly reminder that our content may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Before we begin, I have a favor to ask. Our sponsors would like to hear from you. Could you spare a few minutes to complete a short anonymous survey? Go to podcast.study to connect to the survey. It only takes a few minutes to complete, and it can make a big difference to the show. If you want to pause the show and take the survey now, I promise to be here waiting for you. That's podcast.study. Ann Arbor was founded in the 1820s, named by the two men who platted the land. They created the name honoring their wives, both named Anne, and in awe of the stand of bur oak trees in the area. At least, that's how the story goes. On May 25th, 1824, the 650-acre parcel 40 miles west of Detroit was registered at the Federal Land Office in Wayne County. In 1827, it became the county seat of Washtenaw County. Hoping the state would choose Ann Arbor as the location of the new state capital, a large parcel of land was set aside for the purpose. The state instead chose Lansing, which beat out Jackson, Marshall, and Ann Arbor for the honor. In the 1830s, the University of Michigan relocated to Ann Arbor from its home in Detroit. They moved on to the land that had been set aside for the state capital. It was at this time that the school changed its name from University of Michigania to the University of Michigan. University of Michigan is known as one of the foremost research universities in the United States. Some of its notable alumni include playwright Arthur Miller, lawyer Clarence Darrow, and physician-turned-politician Ben Carson. Both Tom Brady and Michael Phelps are University of Michigan graduates. Musicians Iggy Pop and Madonna attended the university but did not complete degrees. The school is so well regarded that during a 1960 visit to promote formation of the Peace Corps, John F. Kennedy gave a speech in Ann Arbor where he introduced himself as a graduate of the Michigan of the East, Harvard University. When the university arrived, the city of Ann Arbor flourished into a pretty, pleasant, and tree-lined community, with a bustling downtown and even busier campus. In the 1950s, the population of Ann Arbor increased by 20,000 people each fall when students arrived. On the border of Ann Arbor is the town of Ypsilanti, one of those places you have to be from Michigan to know how to pronounce. Ipsy, as she's fondly known, is home to Eastern Michigan University. While only a few miles from the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor, the two schools are very different, University of Michigan having a much higher profile, while Eastern is best known as a great place to earn a teaching degree. Eastern's student body and campus are significantly smaller. In 1951, Eastern Michigan University was still known as Michigan Normal College. The name wouldn't change until 1955. For the purposes of our story, I will be referring to it as Eastern Michigan University, or just Eastern. If you're not familiar with the term normal school or normal college, this is an educational facility designed specifically to train students to become teachers. The term isn't used much these days. Our victim, Pauline Campbell, was 34 years old. Born in Ohio during the First World War, she was placed in an orphanage and later taken in by a farm family. Pauline worked hard to get an education, first cleaning houses, then working as a nurse's assistant until she finished her studies to be a nurse. Pauline was slight, with light brown curly hair and high cheekbones. September 15th was a warm, late summer day in Ann Arbor. By the time her shift ended at St. Joseph's Hospital, it was nearly midnight and the temperature was more comfortable. Pauline was walking from the hospital to her boarding house on Washington Heights, a distance of less than half a mile. She didn't hear anyone creeping up behind her. She probably didn't know what was coming when the heavy mallet smashed down against her skull, sending her to the sidewalk in a heap. She was struck again. Two men approached her as she lay on the sidewalk, her skull fractured, blood leaking from the wounds. One of the men grabbed her shoulders, the other her feet, and they carried her toward a waiting car. The men didn't notice that blood from the attack had sprayed against a nearby car, flung there when the mallet was swung for a second blow. Her attacker didn't realize that Pauline's blood dotted his pants and shoes. Then a voice shouted, "Hey, you'll get blood in my car!" So the two men dropped Pauline's body, grabbed her red leather purse, got into the car, and sped away. This wasn't the first time a nurse walking home after a late shift had been assaulted. A few days earlier, 22-year-old Shirley Mackey, a nurse at the University of Michigan Hospital, was struck with a wrench outside of a dormitory in a robbery attempt. She'd screamed and run away, only stunned by the blow. Mackey was able to give a description of her attacker, but she hadn't had a good look at him. She did recall someone saying, "Good night, Bob," just before she was struck. Because of the assault on Mackey and another less serious attack against a third nurse, University Hospital had beefed up security for employees. Mackey walked away from her attack with some bruises. Pauline Campbell wasn't so lucky. Ann Arbor police jumped on the case. The murder, and a brutal one at that, was a rarity in the town. The Ann Arbor Police Department, or AAPD, was under the leadership of Chief Casper Enkman. He'd taken over in 1946 and ran a relatively progressive department, especially by 1950 standards. AAPD had a female officer, Jewel Reynolds, and in 1950, they hired their first black officer, Clayton Collins. Okay, it's not much by today's standards, but in 1950, it was impressive. Years later, when Collins was asked about his time as an AAPD officer, he said he received very little racism from the department or the community. He remained on the force for 5 years and then opted for a career change. Law enforcement is, after all, a young person's job. AAPD called on Ypsilanti and Milan police for assistance in tracking down the perpetrator who had murdered Pauline Campbell. They, of course, looked at all the, quote, sex deviants, which gave them about 50 people to rule out. Then they looked at Pauline's co-workers, asking that their time be accounted for the night she was attacked. The mayor of Ann Arbor, William J. Brown, visited the scene of the crime, expressed concern about the lack of lighting in the area, and vowed to have additional streetlights installed. He publicly offered a $500 reward, hoping someone would turn in the killer. Brown said, quote, "I can't help but feel that someone else, besides the killer, knows about this brutal slang. He would be doing this community a great service by coming forward." And guess what? Mayor Brown was right. Someone knew about the murder. Someone wanted to do the right thing. That someone was a college sophomore at Eastern named Dan Bowie. On Wednesday, September 20th, Bowie walked into the precinct and told the officer on duty that he had information about the murder. The story that Bowie would tell Detective Dwayne Bauer was intriguing and pushed the investigation in a new direction. Police had been looking at local deviants, criminals, even Pauline's co-workers. The perpetrators of this terrible crime were far more frightening. Pauline Campbell had been attacked by 3 teenage boys from good families, beaten and robbed for the money in her purse, left for dead on the side of the road, just a few feet away from the safety of her home. Dan Bowie had been in some trouble. Nothing too serious, but he was on probation and looking to stay on the right side of the law. He'd received well-intended lectures from his father, a Methodist minister, about doing the right thing, making good choices. The same conversations all parents have with their kids at some point. Bowie had decided he wanted a good life and a future. His goal was to get through his probation and stay out of trouble. When he ran into his friends, Bill Morey and Max Pell, days before the murder, Morey confided in him about the attack on Mackey. Bowie would later testify that Morey laughed when recounting how Mackey had cried out and yelped when he hit her with a wrench. Pell said that he'd laughed so hard over the attack on Mackey at how she'd cried out that he could barely drive away from the scene. Bowie knew the two men from high school. He also knew David Royal, but had only met him a week or two before the attacks in Ann Arbor. And the names he gave to Detective Bauer were Bill Morey Max Pell, and David Royal.
While Dan Bowie didn't know for certain that it was Maury and his friends that had killed Campbell, it certainly sounded like something they would do. The way Maury and Pell had laughed about assaulting Nurse Mackie, it troubled him. The story that Bowie told Bauer was enough to convince investigators. He walked into the department at 3 p.m., and by 5 p.m., the Ypsilanti police chief, accompanied by a captain from his department, arrested Max Pell at Duran Chevrolet, where he worked as a mechanic. At 5:30, the duo arrested Maury at his Pearl Street home. At 5:45, detectives from Ann Arbor and the Michigan State Police are in Milan arresting David Royal. They will have confessions in hand by 11 p.m. that night. Thursday morning, the three teens are arraigned in Ann Arbor before Judge O'Brien. The trial will start in less than a month. After being picked up by police, the trio was taken to the state capitol in Lansing, a 70-mile trip, to be questioned by detectives with the state police. Pell confessed first, with Royal confessing next. Maury held out the longest, but eventually said that he was there, but he was too drunk to remember exactly what had happened to the woman in Ann Arbor. Pell's car was loaded with evidence. Inside, they found bloodstains and the murder weapon. Pell confessed when police told him they would take apart his car, a 1948 Chevrolet Club Coupe, to get the evidence they needed. Hoping to spare his beloved car from damage, he told his story, including the part where he'd used a hose to clean her blood out of his car. Bill Maury's parents were devastated to learn what their son had done, the crimes he'd committed. Maury's father, Bill Maury Jr., was quoted as saying, "There's never been any trouble in this family before. This is hard to understand." Made especially difficult when police found bloodstained clothes their son was wearing the night of the murder in his bedroom at the Maury home in Ypsilanti. What made Bill, a handsome kid with many good things going on in his life, decide to assault, rob, and murder defenseless women for cash? 18-year-old Bill Maury was in the Naval Guard. He'd recently completed training at the Naval Air Station on Grosse Isle outside of Detroit. The Grosse Isle Naval Station was one of the premier training bases for Navy pilots and the Royal Air Force during World War II. Former President George Herbert Walker Bush did his training there in the 1940s. Maury's future looked promising. He'd saved his money and he'd enrolled at Eastern Michigan University for the fall semester. Max Pell was an only child. He'd been a good student at Roosevelt, as in Teddy, High School in Ypsilanti. He played football and ran track. But the spring of 1951 brought a change in him. He dropped out of school and went south looking for work. He'd returned home briefly and then went to Oregon to work as a logger. That didn't suit him either, so he'd come home late in the summer getting a job at a local garage. Pell had also gotten into trouble with Ypsilanti police in the spring of 1951 when he'd left the scene of an accident. The first week of September, he was caught stealing gasoline and fined $15. David Royal, the third and youngest member of the crew, had dropped out of school in his sophomore year. He'd enlisted, but was discharged on a medical because of a bad knee, less than a month into his service. In 1951, he'd been charged with traffic violations and caught rummaging through cars in the Willow Run parking lot, but he was never in serious trouble. He was known to police in his hometown of Milan, which is located 10 miles south of Ann Arbor. Royal wasn't close friends with Pell or Maury. He'd met them late in the summer, and they'd only recently started hanging out. Pell and Maury especially liked Royal because he usually had money. He worked construction and earned a decent living at it, so he was willing to kick in money for gas or beer on a Friday night. A fourth man, 18-year-old Daniel Myers of Ypsilanti, was arrested and charged in the assault on Nurse Shirley Mackie. He would be tried separately on a lesser charge, and despite testimony from many as to his upstanding character, he would be found guilty. Ann Arbor was a safe place to live, study, and work. And while violent crime did occur, it was rare. When Pauline's body was discovered, her Hers was only the third violent death in the city since the 1950s began. In August of 1950, Stanford Thompson was arrested and charged in the shooting death of his ex-girlfriend. In February of 1951, Anita Velasquez was found dead in her apartment, her throat slashed. Her husband, Marcelo, was nowhere to be found. He'd fled to Austin, Texas, where his own family turned him in to local authorities. Marcelo Velasquez was tried and found guilty in the death of his wife. While both of these murders were violent and terrible, both were attacks on women, but they were not random attacks by strangers. The murder of Pauline Campbell created a stir in the community. People were frightened. Thankfully, Dan Bowie, the sophomore at Eastern Michigan University, came forward and arrests were made. The subjects of these arrests rocked the community. Residents of Ypsilanti and Milan were stunned that boys from their towns could have done something so horrible and shown no remorse for the death of a defenseless nurse. As police questioned the boys, the story came out. The night of September 15th, the trio went to the Ideal Tavern in Milan to buy beer. They knew the proprietor would sell to them despite being underage. The legal drinking age in Michigan was 21. The trio then picked up some girls, and the five of them drank and partied until the girls had to be home at 11 p.m. After that, they drove into town. Pell was driving, with Bill beside him and their new friend David in the back seat. The three were short of cash, low on gas, and a little drunk. Bill spotted a woman walking alone, headed away from the hospital. He told Pell to pull over. Morey picked up a rubber-headed mallet, something that Pell used at the garage to bump the dents out of cars. Morey hefted the mallet, slipped quietly from the car, and hurried along the grass to catch up with the nurse, who was not aware of the danger lurking nearby. When he got close enough, he swung the mallet, connecting with the side of Campbell's head. Morey later said, "She didn't even know I was behind her. I hit her twice and she dropped to the sidewalk." Morey didn't know that when he swung the mallet to hit her again, he left a spray of blood on the door of a car parked nearby. That's the amount of force he was using. The teens tried to carry the still-breathing Campbell to the car, but Pell didn't want her blood to ruin his ride. So they abandoned her body next to the road, figuring she would be considered a hit-and-run. From her purse, they took all of the money, totaling about $1.50. Morey explained that they needed the money for gas, and hopefully, if there was enough in her purse, they could also buy more beer. They tossed her red handbag over a bridge into the Huron River. The bloody mallet remained in the back seat of the car. The three of them were hungry and stopped at the Fifth Wheel restaurant on the Willow Run Expressway. If you're curious, I believe that the Willow Run Expressway was the stretch of what is now I-94 that runs from the Willow Run campus east into Detroit. It was built in the early 40s to help the bomber production at Willow Run connect with the Port of Detroit. It was a 21-year-old medical student named Christian Helmus that discovered a mortally injured Pauline Campbell and called for help. One of Campbell's neighbors in the boarding house actually heard the crime, including the car door slamming and the Chevy racing from the scene. She'd had no idea she was ear witness to a murder. The trial began October 31st with jury selection. Honestly, don't you love the quick turnaround on these things? When the trial started in earnest on November 2nd, Morey was called to the stand and he testified that he'd been drinking heavily. Then in the hours between 8 p.m. and midnight, he'd consumed 10 beers, possibly as many as 12. William R. Morey III was tall and handsome. The courtroom was often filled with girls from the local high school who had skipped classes to watch the proceedings. When asked if he could recall the attack, he said he remembered being out of the car. He remembered Dave Royal pulling at him, but little else. Washtenaw County Prosecutor Douglas Reading asked him point blank if he'd struck Pauline Campbell with a mallet, and Morey responded that he didn't know. Reading held up the mallet, the murder weapon, for Morey and tried to hand it to him. Morey refused to take it, and it clunked heavily to the floor. Next, Prosecutor Reading presented photos of Campbell's injuries to Morey. Morey glanced at the pictures and then turned his head away so he couldn't see them. "Why won't you look at her?" Reading demanded of him. "It isn't pretty," was Maury's response. Maury's attorney, Ralph Keyes, brought up many times during his questioning of the three defendants that they'd been drinking beer all evening. "You see, being under the influence is a mitigating factor in someone's guilt or innocence. Under Michigan law at the time, if someone is under the influence of alcohol, they cannot be convicted of first-degree murder with its mandatory life sentence, no parole. The death penalty wasn't an option either. Michigan was the first state to abolish its use back in 1847. Pell was next on the stand. He admitted to letting Maury out of the car before Campbell was killed, but he denied they were following him. Rather, that he and Royal were looking for Maury, who had disappeared after exiting the car. Pell was a frustrating witness, repeatedly responding, "I don't know," to Reading's many questions. Pell also revealed something that had puzzled investigators. Shirley Mackey heard someone call out, "Good night, Bob," just before she was struck. This was a code that Pell and Maury worked out as part of the game of assaulting people, to confuse their target with a false name. Royal was next on the stand. He testified he didn't know how they'd ended up in Ann Arbor. He said that Bill got out of the car and hurried after a girl. When they caught up with him, Royal's window was down and Bill Maury called to him for help. When he exited the car, he saw a woman on the ground. Maury asked him to grab her arm. Until he got out of the car, he hadn't been able to see Campbell on the ground. She'd been concealed behind a parked car. Royal said he was frightened and did as he was told. Pell told them to leave her and get in the car, so that's what he did. Aside from the testimony of the accused, I have a feeling that the testimony of Ann Arbor Police Officer Walter Dedula held weight with the jury. Dedula was the first officer on scene and rode with Campbell to the hospital. He testified that Campbell had tried to speak many times, but she could not form words, and he stayed with her until Pauline took her last breath at the hospital where she'd just finished her shift. They also heard from the pathologist, Dr. Jack G. Weinbaum. He testified that her skull had two fractures and said, quote, "her brain was torn, crushed, and oozing out through the holes in her skull." A grim reminder of the damage done to an innocent victim. A toxicologist from the Michigan Department of Health, Dr. Edwin Kiebla, testified that items taken from Pell's 1948 Chevy were tested and found to have human blood on them. The items removed from the car to be tested included the floor mats, car upholstery, a blanket, and a jacket. Toward the end of the trial, Prosecutor Reading asked the judge that the jury get to examine the wrench used on Shirley Mackey and the mallet that ended Pauline Campbell's life. Keyes leapt to his feet to object, and at that moment, Reading dropped the items to the table, causing a loud crash in the courtroom, a sound that emphasized the heft and weight of these weapons. Spectators giggled at the disruption, causing Judge Brakey to admonish them. He allowed the jury to inspect both weapons. Pell and Royal had also taken the stand in their own defense, but it wasn't enough to spare them. On November 13th, 1951, the case went to the jury, and 3 hours later, they handed out guilty verdicts. A first-degree murder charge for Maury, the mallet wielder, a first-degree murder charge for Pell, the driver, and a second-degree charge for David Royal. On November 23rd, 1951, the trio received their sentence. Pell and Maury were sentenced to life in prison. Royal was sentenced to 22 years. Maury's mother wept openly as the sentence was read. Pell and Royal's mothers were more subdued, pressing handkerchief to their eyes. Marcelo Velasquez was also in court that day to be sentenced for the murder of his estranged wife. After her death, Pauline Campbell's body was taken north to Gratiot County, Michigan, where she was buried in a cemetery near Alma. I wish there was a happier ending to this story. Sadly, there isn't. Pauline Campbell was an innocent victim who died a terrible death at the hands of a young man who cared only for the little bit of cash in her purse. Her head was crushed so some kids could fuel up their car and continue their evening of partying. The Ideal Tavern, which happily sold beer to three underage boys on September 15th, 1951, lost their liquor license before the year was out. The Milan City Council also voted to impose a curfew so that their youths are not out on the street at all hours. All three men, Maury, Pell, and Royal, were sent to prison. David Royal, who received the lightest sentence, second-degree murder, served 10 years and was released in 1962. Max Pell, the driver, was released in 1967, and William Maury III, who had attacked Pauline Campbell, would serve 20 years. While incarcerated, Maury was a model prisoner. He wrote pieces for magazines, coordinated the prison blood drive for the Red Cross, and taught other prisoners to read and write. Michigan Governor William Milliken commuted Maury's sentence in November of 1970. Sure, he'd been a model prisoner, but he committed a terrible crime. Pauline Campbell was an orphan. At the time of her death, she had no husband or children to protest his release. David Lee Royal died in 1995. William Maury III died in 2005, and Max Pell is 84 years old and still living in Michigan. David Bowie, who turned in the perpetrators, died in 1978 when he was 48 years old. If you're wondering, yes, he did get the $500 reward from Mayor Brown. I found a wonderful picture of Walter Dedula from 1958. He's in uniform with his motorcycle. Remember, Dedula was the first on scene with Pauline Campbell and rode with her to the hospital and stayed beside her until she died. He testified about her condition during the ride to the hospital. I think, especially in cases like this, it's important to remember the work that our first responders do, the things that don't make the news, that don't create headlines. We may not know about these moments, but I assure you that the officers never forget them. I've posted a link to the photo on our website, www.alreadygonepodcast.com. Ann Arbor Police Chief Casper Enkman retired in 1960 after 14 years leading the department. The murder of Pauline Campbell and the confession that Enkman patiently coaxed out of 18-year-old Max Pell was the story that was discussed as he retired. This was the most prominent and brutal murder the community had seen. It was the worst case they would see until 1968, when another student from Eastern Michigan University, John Norman Collins, began killing young women in and around Ypsilanti. Enkman died in 1982. He was 76 years old. Mayor Bill Brown, who set to work making Ann Arbor Street safer after the death of Pauline Campbell, died of bone cancer in 1970. Mayor Brown was known for owning car dealerships. As a local, I believe that the Bill Brown Ford dealership in Livonia ties back to this mayor. In an interesting twist, when William Maury III was born in Ypsilanti on January 27, 1933, it was Dr. Brakey that brought him into the world. In November of 1951, it was Dr. Brakey's son, Judge Brakey, who sentenced Maury to life in prison. I came across this case while beginning research on John Norman Collins. Pauline's death and the huge impact it made on the community resonated with me. Her murder was the worst the community had ever seen, and that was the case for 16 years. If you have not yet reviewed the show, please take a moment and join Say Yes More Often, Cassie7676, Turner Storm, Danielle, Starla, Steel Easy, Rejection Hotline, Sadea, Michael, Broken Sticks, and Christy Lee, and leaving a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Our music is created by Luke Superior. You can find him on SoundCloud. And a quick reminder, please go to podcast.study to connect to the survey. It only takes a few minutes to complete, and it can make a big difference to the show. And as always, I appreciate you listening, and please, be good to each other.